All right. Hopefully, is it on? We're good? All right. Excellent. Good. All right. So for the next semester, anyway, we are going to be talking about church history. It's a daunting task, 12 lessons to cover 2,000 years worth of history. So obviously, I won't be able to tell you everything. Not that I even know everything. But we'll do the best that we can, and my hope is that by the end of this, you'll have the big picture of what goes on. If someone mentions Irenaeus or Polycarp, even though those names might sound strange to you now, hopefully you'll know who those people are, and you'll understand why they're important to you. So, to start with, I thought it would be a good idea just to look at why we study history at all. Why is it important? It's important for Christians especially, but it's important for non-Christians as well. And to start off, we're going to define church history, or just history in general. If we can get that first slide, there we go. Technology. Much better than me writing, one for your seeing and for my spelling, which is awful. What is history? History is the study of how people have changed over time. So we're looking at two things in particular. We're looking at people. And we're looking at that change of what they've thought, how they've acted, how they've governed themselves, all these different things. And with church history, we're looking at the study of the church, which is people, the body of Christ, and how that has changed over time. But more specifically, we might say, if you can see this, we might say that history is the remembered stories of how people changed over time. Because, unfortunately, we don't know everything from the past. We are only able to remember the things that have been passed down to us from the past. So we're going to look at some of those remembered stories. And this comes from, if you want to read a book, Ronald Wells, History Through the Eyes of Faith. He was a history professor, I think, at Calvin College. Very good book, just how Christians should think about history. All right, so we'll go to the next slide now, I believe. Yeah, why do we study history? All people study history because without a history, a people have no true concept of who they are or why they think as they do. You don't know. I don't know. Everyone's probably seen movies where the main character of the story suffers from some sort of amnesia. He lives a pitiable life. He has no idea of his past, and therefore he has no idea of the things that surround him, who he is, how he should feel. He's constantly confronted with situations that he has no ability to overcome because he has no remembrance of where he's been before. And this is what happens if, as a person, we forget our own history, our own family identity, our own cultural identity of where we've come from in the past. And it happens to us as a larger group of people if culturally we forget our identity and we forget where we've come from in the past. Now, we specifically, and Christianity as a whole, typically falls within the mainstream of what we want to call Western culture. And we're going to be looking about that some today when, after we get through with this first section, we're going to go on and set the background for the first century church. What was the culture? What were the times that Jesus was born into? And we're going to look at that. So, next slide. Now, for Christians in particularly, we need to be focused on history. First off, about 60% of the Bible is just historical. God tells his people constantly to remember. The Old Testament is constantly, the Israelites are being called to remember who they were as a people, what God has done for them in the past. They are encouraged to remember their history. If they don't remember their history, they are going to forget. This is what happens. They forget what God has done. They sin. They forget what God has done. They go astray. They forget God's commandments and disobey. So we're encouraged to remember history from that perspective. Christians are uniquely interested in history because God is interested in history, and specifically because God entered into history. And that history has a purpose, or a telos, as the Greeks would say, or an end. So God entered into history, physically entered into history in the incarnation, and then brought about the, if you want to call it, the reformation of history or the change of history. And God has purposefully, he tells us in his word, been guiding and shaping and directing history. And we know this goes towards an end. And this is very different from any other culture or civilization. The Hebrews' understanding of history is very different. We'll look at that when we look at the Greeks in just a minute and how their idea of history is different. Now, Thirdly, this is all what I like to call the story. This is something that Seth Drown talks about a lot. This is something we talk a lot about at the Augustine School where I teach. But we are all part of the story. And every other story, no matter what it is, echoes that one story in some sort of way. It has echoes of the story. And this accounts for why so many different cultures and so many different stories seem to echo different parts of the Bible, different sorts of imageries and metaphors and all these different things. So we're part of God's story, the creation, the fall, redemption, all pointing towards the consummation when Christ is going to come back and renew this physical world, transform it, make it perfect, and come and dwell with us. If we don't understand the earlier parts of the story, we're going to have no understanding of our part of the story. Think about it. If you've read The Lord of the Rings, there's a point when Frodo and Sam are in Mordor, and they're sitting there, and they're looking up at the stars, and they're reflecting that, you know, even if Sauron wins and overcomes the entire earth, there's still going to be beauty beyond that. But as they're reflecting on this, they look at one of the stars, and they realize that one of the stars they see in the sky is the Silmaril. Now, if you haven't read The Lord of the Rings, I'm sorry to be using this metaphor, but if you have, then hopefully you'll understand this. But Silmaril is connected to all the earlier parts of Tolkien's history that he created for himself in Middle-earth. So Sam and Frodo realize that their story, which seems so all-encompassing and all-important to them, is merely but one small story in the great story of Middle-earth. And that's what we need to understand about ourselves. Our story is part of the big story of God's creation, the fall, His redemption in history, and the consummation of this world. God coming back. And if we don't understand what's gone on before in this story, we're in trouble. Next slide. All right, so church history. So specific, those are just reasons for studying history in general. Now we're going to look at church history. How has the living out of the Christian faith been viewed in the past? All right, what did other Christians think about? Just the acts of daily living out Christian lives. If you have a question about that, chances are someone in the past has thought about it too. You're not the first person to have this question. Most likely, and they've probably answered it, or someone has answered it in a way that might help you. So, church history. What are the beliefs that Christians have been considered Christian over the centuries? Well, what ideas are Christian and what ideas aren't? Plenty of people claim to be Christians. Plenty of people claim that their ideas are Christian. But do they fit into what have been traditionally considered Christian? If they don't, we probably need to examine those. So, you should view history in a sense as a hedge on orthodoxy, traditional belief. What has the church traditionally said is right teaching? If the church has said that something's out of bounds, probably it's out of bounds still. Unless something we've seen in Scripture contradicts that, which happens. And we'll talk about those instances. So what are the beliefs that have been considered outside? Not just what is inside, but what is outside? If I have a belief, is that inside or is that outside? So the opposite end of that. How have the practices of the church been understood and carried out? How has the church traditionally understood baptism? How has the church understood prayer, fasting, worship? How has the church understood preaching? There are two big schools of preaching in the history of the church. We'll look at both of those. How have they done that? What are the benefits to one and what are some of the problems with some of these? Okay. How has the structure of the church been organized over time? How has the church organized itself? How has it carried out governance, discipline, all these sort of things, and how has the church thought about its role and place in the context of broader society? And this is probably one that we still talk about and deal with a lot today. How has the church viewed itself in the broader context of our world? What should the church be doing in our world? How should we be reacting and interacting with the world? And the church has, over the course of its long history, dealt with this in a number of different ways. Richard Niebuhr, I think, is the man who wrote the book Christ and Culture that says a lot about four traditional views, and we'll look at those later on. Next slide. All right, so anyway, but all of this adds up to something I want to call tradition. And tradition typically, especially in evangelical circles, might have a bad name, but one of the things, I used to be Catholic, so tradition is a little bit more friendly to me, even though a lot of that tradition I've recognized as being not probably the best. But Jaroslav Pelikan, who's probably the foremost Luther scholar of the last 100 years, said in his Jefferson lecture, now every year the National Endowments of Arts picks one person that they think has contributed to the arts every year. In 19, 1983, they asked Yaroslav Pelikan to give an address, and it got turned into a little book of his, and it's called The Vindication of Tradition. And this is what he says about it. Tradition is the living faith of the dead. Traditionalism is the dead faith of the living. So there's a difference here, right? The ideas, the concepts, the things that we believe that are still our beliefs, that other people have believed in the past, that's living, that's tradition. Traditionalism is just things that we do or that are dead, just actions that we go through, things that have no life to them. And tradition lives in conversation with the past while remembering where we are, when we are, and who we have, it is that we who have to decide. C.S. Lewis also said that it is the unremembered past that enslaves us, and that historians are, for all intents and purposes, he said, the most free people that he knows, because not only are they free of the past, I mean the present types of things that they have to decide on because they understand the history of the past, they're also free from the past because they understand it and they can see its problems. So this is why, another reason why, history and tradition, basically what we're going to be studying a lot of is traditions, things that have been passed down to us from older times. Yes, next slide. All right, next thing I want us to understand is, as Christians, if we study history, we are not beginning at the beginning. That should be at, typo. At the beginning, all right? We don't have to go back and reinvent the wheel. We don't have to go back and understand the problems with Christology. We've had people that have gone and done that for us. We can read through that. We can understand their writings, their thoughts. I don't have to go back and start at ground zero or square one. John of Salisbury in 1159 in his Megalogician is quoting here, Bernard of Chartres used to say that we are like dwarves standing on the shoulders of giants so that we can see more than they and things at a greater distance, not by any virtue of sharpness of sight on our part or any physical distinction, but because we are carried high and raised up by their giant stature. So we should claim that, yes, we have maybe more insight than people in the past, but we should be humble in that and say that the only reason we do is because they came before us. We have to understand that we are indebted to the Christian fathers, theologians, great ones who went before us, because it is only because of them that we are able to understand and think and have the ideas that we have today in large part. All right, next slide. All right, so any questions about that? I'll ask very quickly. Any questions on the purpose or study of history? Okay. Well, next I want to talk about the role of the historian. And my goal here is hopefully you might be interested in going and reading church history at some point. Somebody you want to read. And if you do that, you should understand, before you do that, you should understand, right? This is history through my lens, right? I can only tell you how I see history. I can try and be as objective as possible, but I'm going to have preferences. I'm going to have biases. I'm going to have this. And that emphasizes a need, especially on my part, for humility, right? And anyone who comes to study history, you or anyone else, you need to be humble and you need to be empathetic, especially to the time period that you are studying. We don't need to come on with our modernistic thought that we're the best and greatest that have ever lived. Everyone's thought that, but every period, no matter how far back you go, you'll hear them, we're the best, we're the greatest, this is awesome. And we're looking back at them, man, you guys were backwards. But we need to be empathetic. We don't need to sit in judgment over them. We need to seek to understand why they did the things they did, not just judge their actions. We can judge them, sure, but we need to do it in a way that is seeking to understand why they did it. That's more important than it needs to be just saying that I think someone's wrong. Much more important for me to understand why they came to such a wrong conclusion, if I believe it to be wrong. And this is the same with a historian. If you read a historian, there are plenty of good historians out there that will not share your beliefs on everything. I would venture to say that all of them won't. You'll disagree with them on some point. So you need to understand and try as much as you can to understand what their personal preferences and biases are. And each historian has a set of lenses through which he views history. These are his presuppositions, his worldview, if you want to call it like that. So we need to understand what those are. And so, for just you to know, my personal lens or preferences as I study history is I come from a background that's both Church of Christ and Catholic, so I'm going to have kind of a weird kind of blending of those two ideas. And after college, I became convinced that the Reformed faith most aptly, I think, expressed the view of God that I thought was right and the view of the church that I thought was right. So I'm going to be partial to those sort of things. I'm still partial in a lot of ways to certain aspects of Catholic theology and Catholic practice, but just know that going up front, all right? And that I like the ancient and medieval time periods and early American history best. So you'll get more of that than you will of other things just because I like it. And it's my class, so I can choose to teach what I want. So, any questions on the role of the historian? All right. Well, now, for the next 20 minutes or so, I'm going to give you all of ancient history in about 20 minutes. So strap in, because this is the world that Christ came in. Galatians 4 talks about the fullness of time, right? Christ was born at a specific time, in a specific place, for a specific reason. Obviously, we say this. And when we talk about the fullness of time, if we're going to study this idea of the fullness of time and why Christ was born in the time period that he was and what that means for the church, we need to understand three different strains of thought that come and join together in Palestine at the time of Jesus. And these are going to be Hebrew, represented by Jerusalem, Greek thought, and Roman ideas. So we're going to start with Greece, and then we'll go through that to Hebrew and then to Rome, because it kind of flows better, I think, that way. All right. So, next slide. Here's ancient Greece. In the middle of the Mediterranean Sea, more towards the eastern side than the western side. Now, early Greek civilization develops in two places. It develops in Crete, which is this big, long island down here at the very bottom of the screen, if you can see it. And it develops also at a place in the central Peloponnesus, which is that big blob at the bottom of Greece. You want to think about it that way. And these are the Minoan and Mycenaean cultures. And this is the beginning of Greek culture. And these last for a period of 600 years or so. And then for some reason, they're destroyed. We don't know. We can't read Greek writing from this time. So we have very little information about this. But we do know that it seems like their downfall is tied in with the downfall of another number of other ancient civilizations that happened at the same time. The Hittites, the Egyptians went through a lot of things this time. And it seems to be linked to a group of people that historians, for lack of a better term, call the sea people, because they came from over the sea. And that's about the best. Now, in the Bible mentions these people as the Philistines. All right, the Philistines come in, and these are people that would have come over the sea, the best that we could tell, and they caused havoc all over the eastern part of the Mediterranean. This time period of the Mycenaeans and the Minoans is the time period that Homer writes about. Not the period when Homer writes, but it's the period when he writes about. And you can see Troy listed way up here by the Hellespont, way up there. One reason why Troy was such an important city is because it dominated trade in and out of the Black Sea, which is where that leads. All right, next up, we come to a period of the Dark Ages. All right, in the Dark Ages, we don't know a lot. It seems like at the fall of the Mycenaeans and the Minoans, Greek civilization kind of went through a diaspora, and Greek civilization was moved not just into Greece, but also into what we consider Asia Minor, or the eastern side of present-day Turkey. And then after this, we have a period of polis building and city-states arise, and Greek civilization kind of comes out of the Dark Ages. This is when Homer is writing his epics. But this explosion of Greek culture continues, and there's an age of colonization in which the Greeks colonize much of the Mediterranean area. And we'll look at a map of that in just a second. Not yet. All right. And then there's other periods, and we'll talk about each of these in turn. There's a classical period. There's the period of the Persian Wars, Greek Civil Wars, Macedonian domination, or the Age of Alexander, and the Age of Successors. All right, next. All right, so here's the areas that the Greeks colonized. You can see that it is a large portion of the Mediterranean. These would have been areas where Greek colonies and cities would have been founded. All right, so if you're looking for areas where Greek ideas would be present, these are them at the very beginning of Greek civilization. This is before we get to Socrates and Aristotle and all those guys. All right, we'll stay on this one for just a minute. All right, it's in this era after this that Greek pseudoscience and philosophy begin. It begins in a town right here called Miletus. You have people like Thales, Anaximander, Anaxagoras. If you've studied philosophy, these names might be familiar to you. But these are people who sought beyond the myths and legends of the Greeks for explanations, but actually sought scientific or pseudoscientific explanations for things, thought that the sun was a rock the size of Greece. Well, that's a whole lot better than a god pulling a chariot across the sky, we might say. So they're thinking thoughts, and this is going to be important because the Greeks were a people who questioned things. And that's something that that cultural heritage is something that is passed on to Christians. They questioned things. They thought that the universe and the world was something that was knowable. It was beyond just the myths, but we had a capacity as man. They had a very high view of man. They viewed that man was the greatest of all creatures. They viewed that man was like a god in a lot of ways and could understand the physical world. This is why their sculptures and their art is the way that it is, because they loved man and they loved the human form. All right, let's see. It's at this time of Greek colonization and expansion that the Greek alphabet is invented. They stole this, by the way, from the Phoenicians, which Phoenicia is right here north of Israel. And the Phoenicians had perfected, and this is a big deal if you think about an alphabet for a minute. This is going to be important because everything, the Bible and all this, is written in Greek. Alphabet's a big deal. You might think, well, what's the difference between different types of ancient writing? Well, ancient writing starts with pictures for words. Think about how many words there are. Hundreds and hundreds of thousands of words, which require hundreds and hundreds of thousands of different pictures. Well, they get better than that. Then we move down to syllabic symbols. So symbols for different syllables. Well, that's a lot better. You might be down, instead of to hundreds of thousands, to just hundreds of different symbols. And eventually the Phoenicians narrow it down to just symbols for individual sounds, without vowels, by the way, like Hebrew. And then the Greeks are the ones who add the vowel symbols. And this is going to be very important. Greek is going to be the best language available for writing. And it is going to remain that way until all even throughout the Roman Empire. When Constantinople falls, which is the new Roman capital where Byzantium is right there, when Constantinople falls, they're still speaking Greek. So the Romans, especially in the East, use Greek. Now in the West, we have more of a Latin tradition because of the Romans, and we'll talk about that later. Next slide. All right, so the School of Athens. This is in Athens at this time. Develops a form of government called democracy, which is very different than the other Greek forms of government. The other Greek forms of government that you had kings, you had tyrants, which sound a whole lot like kings, but they weren't hereditary. And you had oligarchies, which is just ruled by a select group of elite noblemen. All right, but in Athens, we have a democracy. And in Athens also, we have a development of and sophistication in philosophical thought. So here's a famous painting by Raphael. Now, this is in the bedroom of one of the popes. This would be a nice bedroom piece to have. He also has the Battle of the Milvian Bridge, which we'll talk about in a couple of lessons from now. But here we have this. And I want to talk about the ideas behind the Greek. And we're going to focus mainly on the two guys in the middle. Aristotle is here. Plato is here. You look over here. Supposedly this is the self-portrait of Raphael, who's standing and the only man that's looking out at you from the painting. But there's a number of other guys here that are famous guys too. You have Aristarchus, you have Ptolemy, you have a number of different people. But the guys in the middle are the ones that we're really focused on, Aristotle and Plato. And their views of reality are going to continually influence Christian thinkers. Christian thinkers at one point or another are going to have to come into contact and deal with what is the mainstream understanding of the world in the Greek and Roman world, and it centers on these two guys. Plato believes in abstract ideas or forms that then influence reality, so he's a top-down kind of guy. And Aristotle believes that forms and things exist, but we can't know about them except through individual types of things. So Aristotle's more of a bottom-up type of guy. So those are going to be important. We'll talk more about how those influence Christianity later, but I want you to understand that it's at this time. All right, next. What do we have next? Oh, okay. We'll come to that in a minute, so just wait for him. All right. So during this time period of Greek political growth, Greece comes into contact, especially the colonies in Asia come into contact with the Persian Empire. You know about the Persian Empire from the Bible? Persian Empire conquered the empire of the Babylonians. Darius and Cyrus the Great, Cyrus's son Cambyses conquered Egypt. And then more of them conquered into Asia and eventually conquered most of Asia Minor and conquered all the Greek city-states. Now, eventually these Greek city-states rebel. Miletus, the philosophical place that we talked about, is the one who leads the rebellion. And the Athenians, who are ethnically or tribally related to them, send some ships as aid. And the Persians kind of defeat the Greek city-states, and they're like, that wasn't very nice of those Greeks across the water over there to send aid, so we're going to go and teach them a lesson. They load up a bunch of ships and go over there, and Athens sends for help to Sparta, which is the most powerful city-state in all of Greece. And if you can read about the Spartans. The Spartans' emphasis on strength and courage and their battle tactics is legendary, and their method of raising children is probably not what we want to imitate, but interesting, to say the least. They send to help the Spartans, and the Spartans say, oh, well, we'd like to come, but we're having a religious festival, and we can't. Sorry. And so the Athenians are left on their own, and 10,000 or so Athenians defeat 30,000 Persian soldiers at the Battle of Marathon, and this is where we get the Marathon race from. It's about 26 or so miles from Marathon back to Athens, and the guy runs it back and forth to tell them, because the Persians had divided their army, not necessarily a great thing to do, but they divided their army, and one army was going to attack the Greeks at Marathon, and the other army they were going to sail around and attack Athens. Well, Athens defeated it, guy ran and told the Greeks in the city that the army was coming so they would know, and then the army marched there and was waiting for the Persians when they arrived. If you could picture them with their 10,000 spears standing right on the edge of the water just waiting for the Persians just turned around and sailed back. So the Spartans arrive a couple of days later and see this, but this is a great Athenian victory, and the Athenians' rise in power is really dated beginning about this time. And eventually Athens and Sparta become rivals. The Persians invade again under Xerxes. Or no, not Xerxes, but Anaximander. No, not Anaximander. What is his name? Do I have it written down? I can't believe I forgot that. Do I have it? No, I don't. Well, anyway, one of the Persian kings invades Greece with about 500,000 people. The Greeks are defeated at Thermopylae, which you can read about, where the Spartan king and 300 Spartans and a number of other Greeks die. Athens is destroyed. The Athenians have to flee out into the Bay of Salamis. But they fight a great sea battle in the bay, and the Athenians, who are a great naval power at this time, win and destroy the Persian navy, and the Persian army has to retreat because they can no longer get supplies because their navy has been destroyed. And then the Spartans and Athenians and a number of other Greeks join together and defeat the Persian army, the smaller Persian army that's been left behind. And Greece is free from Persian control. Persia will never invade Greece again. Now, the Greeks don't know this, obviously. The Persians have just invaded twice, so they decide to form a league to protect them. And Sparta says, no, we don't want to really be a part of this league. The Spartans didn't like being away from home. They had about seven times as many people as there were actually Spartans that were slaves of theirs. They're called the Helots. So they don't like being away, because the longer they're away, the more likely are those tens of thousands of Helots will decide, we don't like this, which they don't. And the Helots will rebel a number of times against Sparta, but that's another story. So this is the rise of Athens. Athens rises to power. Athens forms what's called the Delian League, and then there's a civil war between Sparta and its allies on one hand, Athens and its allies on the other hand. Athens loses. But this period of infighting, which lasts beyond just the Peloponnesian Wars and lasts into a number of other wars where Sparta and Thebes and a number of other people end up fighting, culminates in them being conquered by an outside power. Philip II of Macedonia conquers Greece and then is most likely murdered, probably by his son Alexander, and then Alexander rises to power, and Alexander decides that the best way to unite Greece and to unite the people is to stop him being there, where they can think about him, and then take all of his army and conquer the Persians, which he does. It takes him 11 years to conquer the whole Persian Empire, which is not very long. Here's the Battle of Issus. This is the second battle in which you can see Alexander way over there on the left. There's Darius III there in the middle. Alexander defeats the Persian Empire, captures all of it, marches all the way to India with his men, and then dies at the age of 33 in Babylon, probably of malaria. But what has happened is that Alexander has taken Greek culture with him in the course of his conquests. He takes Greek culture with him. And Greek culture, Greek language, Greek views, Greek ideas are going to spread all over the eastern part of the Mediterranean. And they're going to be left there because when Alexander dies, his empire is divided up among his four generals. And the two that we really need to be concerned about are guys by the name of Seleucus and Ptolemy. And the Seleucids are going to rule Mesopotamia. You can go to the next slide, I believe. Yes. The Seleucids are the green and most of the yellow over there. They conquer the yellow part. And the Ptolemies are the purple. Now, this is a later part in it when, at the beginning, the Ptolemies would have controlled Judea and Phoenicia, and the Seleucids wouldn't. But you can see, these are the two greatest. The other two generals get stuck with Greece and Thrace, which is not very big. So they kind of go out of the picture eventually. But the Seleucids and the Ptolemies are going to be very important. And now we're going to move on to Hebrew history, because it's at this point where Greek and Hebrew history really intersect in a very important type of way. And we're going to get into what's called the intertestamental period. There are a number of sources for this. If you want to read about the intertestamental period, I would encourage you to read the books of 1st and 2nd Maccabees, which as Protestants we don't have in our Bible, but other Christians do. It's part of the Apocrypha. Other things that you could read would be Josephus and his Antiquities of the Jews, and there's a number of other books that you can read. But what we have here when we get to the Greek and Hebrew kind of confrontation are two diametrically almost opposed worldviews. Their views of God, the Greek views of God, was that God was this unknowable thing that existed outside of time and space, and we can't really know anything about him. He just sits out there and just kind of moves stuff around. The unmoved mover is one of the terms that is used to describe him. But the Hebrew God is a God who is personal and furthermore is very interested and involved in history and time and creation. They have different views of history. Greek history was everything just repeated. It's just a big cycle. It just goes around and around and around. What has been is just going to be repeated again. Hebrew history is very purposeful. It's directed. It's a line more than a circle. The Greeks emphasized individuality. It's all about the individual. Whereas the Hebrews were a tribe of people and found their identity not as a person or an individual, but as a part of a tribe. And then where does authority come from? Greeks believed that authority came from people, from the people. The people gave authority to the ruler, in a sense. Whereas the Greeks did that. The Hebrews believed that authority came from God and was given by God. So we have very different views. Not only that, but we have all the different ways in which Hebrews were just physically different. They ate certain types of food. They practiced circumcision, which was abhorrent to the Greeks. Awful. Why would you mess up your physical body in some sort of way? I mean, when you have this high view of the perfection of man, to start lopping off parts of it doesn't really set too well. All right. So here we go. The Egyptians, the Ptolemies, were fairly tolerant of the Jews. Ptolemies were a fairly tolerant empire, but they lose Judea in 200 AD when it is conquered by the Seleucids. And the Seleucids are going to have a much less tolerant view of Jewish practices. And this is going to come about in the reign of Antiochus IV, who's called Epiphanes, which means the manifestation, basically like the manifestation of the God. So obviously, he's going to have a very high view of himself. And he's going to begin interfering with religious practice in Judea. He's going to do this in a number of ways, mostly by just removing high priests that he likes or doesn't like and just swapping them out at will. Let's see, where am I? Right there. But he goes down and fights a battle with the Ptolemies after this all begins. And the rumor comes back to Jerusalem that he's dead. And the Jews are like throwing a party. Woo, he's dead, finally. He wasn't dead. And he didn't like that. So he comes back to Jerusalem and he besieges and sacks the city. Doesn't destroy it, but kills tens of thousands of Jews in the city. He goes in, and this is when he erects the abomination of the desolation that Lee talked about. Sacrifices pigs on the altar of the temple and forbids Jewish religious practice. This is when the tale of the woman and her seven sons comes about, which is this tale in the Maccabees where a woman refuses to, and her sons refuse to sacrifice and are murdered. Eventually, though, there's a priest outside of Jerusalem named Matthias. He rebels against this, kills the king's official and a Jew who was going to sacrifice to Zeus, and a rebellion starts. And for a time, anyway, Jews in Judea win their independence. This is a very long process. He has seven sons, the most famous of which is Judas. They are called the Maccabees. And they establish both a hereditary high priesthood and a hereditary kingship that lasts all the way until the time of Christ, even though the person on the throne at the time of Christ, Herod, only is a married in member of the family. But that high priesthood, in a way, is still, or that practice is still going on, even though he's supported by the Romans. But at the same time, Jewish political factions begin to develop. You have the Sadducees, which are a priestly temple sect. You have the Pharisees, which are, and the scribes, which are more of a lay, devout, religious sect. You have Essenes, which are people that kind of remove themselves into these monastic communities out in the desert to get away from all the things that they saw going on in Jerusalem. And then you have Zealots, who, as the Romans come in again and establish an outside authority over Jerusalem, begin to push for that to be overthrown. Let's see, how much time? I've got about 5 minutes. Oh, good, 5 minutes for Rome. Okay. Now, it's at this time, during this conflict between Jerusalem and the Jews and the Seleucids, that the Jews are looking for help. Who can we ask to help us against the Seleucids? Well, Judas Maccabeus, and this is documented with Roman records, sends an envoy to Rome, and they sign an alliance. And this alliance is going to be kept up throughout the Hasmoneans, and the Hasmoneans, or however you want to pronounce them. And Rome is going to become an ally of the Jews against the Seleucids. Now, Rome, by this point, is a great power. It's risen from a very small city. You can go to the next slide, I think. There's more Seleucids. Next slide. All right, intertestamental. We can keep on going. Let's keep on. We've done that. I forgot about all these slides, obviously. All right, Jews of the diaspora. This is the areas in which Jews settle by the time of Christ. We'll talk about that some more next week, too. I didn't have time to get to that. Next one. Sources, next one. This is the Hasmoneans. There's the kingdom at their height. Sorry, I know we're rushing fast. There they are fighting the Seleucids. Yes. Next, we go on to Rome. Here we go. So Rome begins in 753 BC, a little town on the Tiber River on seven hills, and expands. There's seven mythical kings. Rome overthrows their kings and forms a republic, which is a very unique form of government. And Rome expands from this very small city to eventually covering all of Italy. And then kind of by accident, they stumble into this world, for them, wide empire. They fight three trading wars with Carthage that are known as the Punic Wars. And then when other countries like Greece and the countries in Asia Minor help Carthage against Rome because they're worried that Rome is getting too powerful, we can't have just people helping our enemies without paying them back. And so they go and do. And this leads to Eastern expansion so that by the time we get to this last period that I want to talk about that leads up to the time of Christ in Rome and where they intersect, Rome has gone from a very small power to covering from Spain, Italy, North Africa, Greece, and Asia Minor. All right? Now, the problem with the Roman system of government was we have presidential elections every 4 years, and those are lots of fun. The Romans had them every year, and they were just as much fun, except it happened every year. And there were two of them. That wasn't even that great, because the Romans had this fear of one person having power. That's why they got rid of the king. Now, what they didn't have a way of really solving, though, was the power that was going to be amassed by the generals in all these wars that they were fighting. And what you had was you had civil unrest that was caused by these wars. The Romans fought wars pretty much straight through for a period of about 200 or 300 years of just constant fighting. This led to civil unrest. It led to a lot of slaves that weren't happy about being slaves. This led to slave rebellions like Spartacus, which you maybe have seen the movie Spartacus. 150,000 slaves all over Italy revolt and go about the countryside murdering and pillaging until they're destroyed. But you have generals that come back to power and aren't happy because their soldiers aren't, the promises that the government gave their soldiers aren't fulfilled. So generals begin taking over the Roman government. Marius and Sulla are the two most important ones to think about this. But eventually, this is going to continue to happen. Rome has no way of solving this problem. And there's just a constant state of civil unrest and civil war that culminates with Julius Caesar. And let's see what the next slide is. Oh, there's Roman expansion in Italy. Next slide. There's a picture of Rome. Next slide. Here's Roman expansion to the time of Christ. Julius Caesar, who has conquered Gaul, which is modern-day France, comes back, and he's going to be punished for supposed crimes. He doesn't want to be punished, so he leads his army into Italy and overthrows the Roman government, defeats his enemies, and then is murdered. His murderers then, there's another civil war, so we just finished one civil war. Now we have his murderers versus his nephew and lieutenant, Octavian and Mark Antony. They fight a big war. Octavian and Mark Antony win. They divide the empire between themselves, and then they fight a civil war, which culminates in the Battle of Actium, which is a naval battle that's fought right here off the coast of Greece. And that leaves Octavius as the sole ruler of the Roman world. And it's no wonder, after 200 or 300 years of fighting, and the better part of just 100 years of straight civil war, that the Roman people were worn out and tired of the Republic and were only too happy to begin accepting solitary emperors, especially when the first emperor reigned for such a long period of time. If you want to think about him reigning from about 44, 42, I think, is when the Battle of Actium is fought. No, 31 is when Actium is fought, B.C. He's going to reign for the better part of 30 or 40 years, and the Roman world is going to be completely at peace. And it's during the reign of Augustus that the doors to the temple of Janus are shut. And these only are shut when there is no war anywhere in all the Roman Empire. And that happens two times. And one of them happens during the time when Christ is born. And so it's into this period, this first period in hundreds of years, when the known world is finally at peace. And is going to remain at peace, by and large, until about 200 A.D., when the last of the five good emperors ends. The world is going to remain at peace for the next 200 years, by and large. There'll be small wars and things like that, but nothing major like is what's been going on. And this is the time into which Christ is born. So when we talk about the fullness of time, we're talking about these three Greek thought, Hebrew thought, and then Roman. Go to the next slide, please. Oh, that's it. Never mind. Roman expansion and power and this peace that Rome brings to the known world is going to be the time into which Jesus is born. We have a universal language. We have people who think deep ideas about God and about the meaning of the universe. We have Jews scattered all over that world who will know and be familiar with the stories of Scripture. And we have Greeks who come into contact with them, who are going to know about them and be influenced by them. And then we have this worldwide empire that's going to establish peace and eventually is going to establish a road and networking system that is unrivaled and unparalleled until modern times. And it's into this world that Christ is born in the fullness of time. All right, and I think we're done. Any questions really quickly before we finish? All right, well then, I'll pray for us. Oh, yeah. Oh, I'm sorry. I didn't see a hand. Yeah. Okay, that's interesting. The Romans adopted something called the trinomen, which is this three-name system. This is why we use three names, by the way. They had a personal name, they had a family name, and they had a tribal name. So when you talk about Julius Caesar isn't, his real name wasn't Julius. His family would have called him Gaius. And then he's a member of the Julian and Caesari, the Julian tribe and the Caesari family. And the reason why he was called Julius Caesar is because he was the head of both of those. So he was the Caesari. He was the one. He was the head of that clan and of that family. So he had a personal name. So Octavian, obviously, was not a member of the, he wasn't a member of the Julian. He was a member of the Claudian family. But he was married, his sister and Caesar, I think, were brothers and sisters. And Caesar didn't have a son, so when Caesar died, his will adopted Octavian. So Octavian then adopted, and the name Augustus is actually a title that was bestowed on him by the Roman Senate. So he then took that as his, now he has like four names. This is common. They do this all the time in Roman history. There's a guy that's named the One-Eyed. There's another guy that names his son Britannicus because he conquers Britain, so he gives his son this extra name. So this happens often. But yeah, Roman naming practices are odd. And then to complicate it, they weren't very creative in their names. So you have, like, take Constantine. Constantine has a son named Constantine. He has another one named Constantius. He has another one named Constance. And his daughters are Constantia, and then Constantia again, and then Constantia again. So they really were pretty... So you have a lot of people with the same names repetitively showing up, and you have to kind of differentiate between them. Any other questions? That's a good question. All right, well, if not, then it's time. We'll pray. Thanks. Father, we thank you for the time that we've had to come and study about the world that you've created and how that world and the history of the people who have lived before us affects us and continues to affect us today and affected you. And we recognize your work in that, and that you direct all history towards your purposes, even when we cannot know and understand what those are. And we thank you that in your providence, in the fullness of time, you sent your Son, Jesus Christ, into this world, and that he lived a perfect life, and that he died for our sins and was raised on the third day so that we might enjoy you forever. And in the name of your Son, who did all of these things, we pray. Amen.